love you, I whispered back. I've got a job. It's in Canada. Will you come with me? We'll get married first, of course. Yes, I'll come with you. And yes, we'll get married. I looked over his shoulder and saw my mother looking at us with tears in her eyes. I wanted to cry too, because she'd hardly been home 5 minutes. And now I was about to go away. It turned out that last Saturday Gary had told my mother of his longing for an Everton football kit, so this afternoon she'd gone into town with Cathy and bought one. When they got home, Cathy had found Rob's sister's telephone number and my mother had rung and invited Rob and Gary to tea. The telephone had been ringing when they arrived home after seeing bedknobs and broomsticks, Rob said. Anyway, my mother said later, I felt really sorry for him. Rob, that is. You deserting him for another man. How did you get on with Stephen Conway? It was dead boring, I told her. I felt like a fish out of water. You'll be safe with Rob, love. She squeezed my hand. Across the garden, Rob was helping Gary climb down a tree. You'd never know where you were with Stephen. Oh, and don't forget you got two aunties in Canada, Jackie and Biddy, as well as two uncles and five cousins, three boys and two girls. I've promised to stay with them over Christmas. They all live in British Columbia, where Rob's job is. The job was head of security in an electronics factory that had just opened on Vancouver Island. The offer had come from a Canadian friend who'd worked with Rob in Uganda. The factory belonged to his brother. By now everyone knew that Rob and I were getting married, even Gary, who wanted to know if he still had to call me Miss. I said I wanted to be called Pearl, knowing I would never replace his mother. My mother asked if I would do her a favour. Give Marion a ring and tell her you're marrying Rob. It wouldn't look good for you or Charles to blurt it out when you got home. Poor old thing, she can't stand me. I never liked her either, but I managed not to make a song and dance about it. Tell you what, invite her over. Charles has gone to buy champagne for a toast, and she should be part of it. All right. I turned to leave, but remembered there was something I had to know. Are Charles and Cathy having an affair? I asked as quietly as I could. Her jaw dropped a mile. Of course not. What on earth gave you that idea? I explained about bringing her blue cardigan round last Sunday and all the curtains being closed. Charles was here. His car was outside. So it was you who left the cardigan on the step. We thought it was Marion. It was the sort of thing she'd do. She laughed. No, love. Cathy and Charles were watching a science fiction film. They mustn't have heard you knock. You know how much Marion hates them. Cowboy films, too, and refuses to have them on in the house. Charles is easygoing to a fault and lets her get away with it, silly man. It's about time he put his foot down. I telephoned Marion, and she said she'd come over. She sounded very emotional, so I was glad I'd rung. She arrived about 20 minutes after Charles had returned with the champagne. Cathy didn't have any champagne glasses, but nobody cared. We stood in a circle in the garden, and Grandad made the toast. To Pearl and Rob, may they enjoy everlasting happiness and provide a plentiful supply of brothers and sisters for little Gary here. Pearl and Rob. Glasses were raised, champagne drunk, and everyone began to sing Auld Lang Syne. I don't know why. I want three brothers and three sisters, Gary announced when the singing stopped. I told Hilda my news when I arrived at school on Monday. We both drove in at the same time and parked our cars next to each other. Congratulations, she said warmly. When will it be? She was really thrilled to be able to attend my wedding. Towards the end of July. My mother's going to the church this morning to see what dates are free. It won't be a big affair. You're invited, of course. Thank you. Your mother is a lovely person, Hilda said sincerely. I'm sorry for the things I said that time. You build up a picture in your mind of what people are like. And I couldn't have been more wrong in your mother's case. I suppose even the nicest people can do things on the spur of the moment that they'll always regret. What's happening with Clifford? I asked, changing the subject. Clifford said he doesn't want any more children. He has two from his first marriage, and they're enough for him. She kicked a football back to its owner with rather more force than was necessary. I think it's fair to say he's only marrying me to get a roof over his head. I'm sorry, Hilda. She really was due some happiness in her life. There's no need to be sorry. I'm still going to marry him, she said surprisingly. I'm pretty certain that I'm pregnant. By the time he finds out, we'll be married, and if he wants to leave, he can. I won't care because I'll be a married woman, and pretty soon I'll be a mother, which is all I've ever wanted out of life. Now that there were two weddings about to take place, it was no surprise when it turned out there would be another. Kathy Burns called me into her office at lunchtime and announced she and Uncle Harry were to be married. We've always got on well together ever since we met on Southport Pier. It was the day your mother met your dad, she said. She was pink and flushed and pretty, and I could suddenly imagine what she must have been like as a young woman during the war. That was 32 years ago. If it hadn't been for Harry, I would never have met Jack, who was the love of my life. I'm really, really glad, I said. Next to my own wedding, it was the best news I could have had. I'm glad Uncle Harry proposed at last. He didn't, Pearl. I proposed to him. She laughed so loudly with such gusto, I thought it would be heard all over the school. Left to himself, he would never have found the nerve. He accepted like a shot. We're going on a world cruise for our honeymoon. Leo is putting back his retirement until we return, and I'm taking a year's leave. I'm so happy, Pearl. I could bust a gut. She laughed again. That's not a very headmistressy thing to say, is it? But I don't care. Oh, Charles, I don't want us to lose our little girl, Marion wept. Her voice was so full of misery that I wanted to cry myself. They were in the living room, and I don't think they realised I was in the breakfast room and could hear every word. We won't be losing her, sweetheart, Charles said soothingly. She'll always be our little girl, and we can go to Canada and see her at Christmas. Isn't our Amy arranging a great big do? But she won't be here, in this house with us. She won't bring home her new clothes for me to see. There won't be a pot of tea waiting when we get back from work. She won't be here. Charles. I know, sweetheart, but I'll always be here for you, and you for me. Will you, Charles? Marion asked tearfully. You know I will, sweetheart. I went into the kitchen, not wanting to hear any more, but glad they were getting on again. Charles and Marion had never realised how thin the walls were in their house. They must have been even thinner in the bungalow where I'd lived with my mother and father. I remember that I could clearly hear everything that was said when I was in bed, even though the door to my room had been closed. I used to pull the clothes over my head, but the words never went away. Even now, all these years later, I could hear them still in my dreams. One dream in particular often came back to haunt me. A voice was saying, "I really would like to kill you." And my mother was crying. A little girl, it could only be me, shouted, "Leave Mummy alone!" I'd wanted to get out of bed to save her, but my body felt too heavy to move. It was there that the dream ended, but I wondered if there was another, different ending, and it would come to me one day. Chapter 20, 1971 to 1972. Amy. Nellie Shadwick sat in the back of the Rolls-Royce, which was parked at the side of the road, and drummed her heels against the floor. "What's that?" asked the driver, who was also her brother. "An SOS." "I'm fed up waiting," Nellie complained. "That's because you consider your own time so important you resent wasting it on other people." "Is that such a bad thing, Ducky?" Ducky wasn't a term of endearment, but the name by which her brother David had been known since he was a baby. No one had any idea why. Ducky thought earnestly for a few minutes before saying it wasn't such a bad thing to want, except it was impossible not to waste time. You have to depend on so many other things being on time, too. Buses and trains and taxis, for instance. Then there's folks falling ill at the last minute, snapped shoelaces, not being able to find stuff, all sorts of accidents. The weather, including the occasional meteorite. All right, Nellie said testily. She stretched out her long, slim legs, which were encased in sheer black nylon tights. "Do these look 40 years old to you, Ducky?" Ducky turned round. "Do you mean your legs, your feet, or your shoes, girl?" "Me legs, of course." Ducky shook his curly head. "They look more like a good 50 to me." She leaned forward and cuffed him lightly on the side of his head. "Don't be so bleeding cheeky, Ducky Shadwick. Where would you be without your sister?" "Dead, probably," Ducky said solemnly. "Or banged up doing life or begging on the streets. I'd probably have had all me teeth knocked out by now and there'd be scars all over me body." Reflecting that there was a good chance at least one, probably more of these things really could have happened if their Nelly hadn't made good, he added, "Actually, Nell, your legs only look 21. "Are you sure?" "Sure, I'm sure." Nelly looked at her ludicrously expensive watch. It was 8:58. She buttoned up her black quilted coat and pulled the hood over her head. "Are you intending to rob a bank?" inquired her brother, watching her now in the rear-view mirror. "I don't want to be recognised, do I? That's why I hired a car, so no bleeder can track the registration back to yours truly." She stared intently at the door of the grim building across the road. Scarcely a minute passed before the door opened and a small, insipid-looking woman came out, carrying a suitcase. Nelly nearly fell out of the car. "She's here! Oh, look, there she is! There she is!" She began to run. As she got closer, she could see that the woman seemed taller than she'd first appeared, and it was obvious she'd once been very pretty. Nelly continued across the road, her clumpy high heels clattering, jewellery jingling, arms waving. "Amy!" she yelled. "Amy, girl, it's me, Nelly!" Amy gasped when she stepped out of Holloway Prison and was caught up in the sails of what looked like a human windmill, wearing a black hooded coat. Nelly kissed her cheeks, her forehead, her nose and the air around her head, as if Amy were wearing a halo. "It's lovely to see you, Nell," she said, wanting to burst into tears. She was free. She could walk any way she liked along the road in which she was standing. If she had wings, she could fly up into the sky, which was full of black clouds. Not that she cared. "The car's over here." As if Amy could have missed the gleaming Rolls-Royce parked across the way. As Nelly dragged her towards it, a pack of young men, about 10 strong, began to run in her direction, waving notebooks and cameras and yelling that they wanted a photo and an interview. The driver of Nelly's car jumped out and bundled the two women and the suitcase into the back, and 1 minute later the car sped away. Amy looked out of the rear window and saw the pack racing towards their own cars. But it was too late. They were out of sight in no time. "Phew, this is Ducky," Nelly said breathlessly, waving at the driver's back. "He's me youngest brother. Ducky, this is me friend Amy." "How do you do, Amy?" Ducky nodded at the rear-view mirror, in which Amy could see herself. "I've heard an awful lot about you." "Shut up, Ducky." Nelly closed the glass partition. "I don't want big ears listening to everything we say. Don't forget to put your seatbelt on, girl." Amy confessed she'd never come across a seatbelt before and would Nelly kindly show her what to do. "Where are we going?" she inquired.
"Constable country," Nelly replied, fastening the belt.
"Suffolk," she added, in response to Amy's look of incomprehension. "At least that's what it said in the brochure. It's where some painter called Constable did most of his stuff. The elf farm is called Butterflies, and it's in a house that belonged to some lord or other. I've put you in for 3 weeks under the name of Curran, instead of Patterson, like you asked. Me, I can only stay a week. You'll be all right on your own for the rest of the time, won't you, girl?"
"I will. Let me know how much it's costing, won't you, Nelly? I'll settle up while we're there."
"It's not costing you a bleeding penny, Amy. No, no." She waved away Amy's protestations that she really must pay her share. "If you and got hold of me by the scruff of me flaming neck 18 years ago and told me I could make something of myself, I'd still be strutting me stuff on the streets, wouldn't I?"
It was the third time Nelly Shadwick had been sent to Holloway for soliciting that she met Amy, who recognised straight away that, although Nelly, who had inherited her creamy coffee-coloured skin and exotic eyes from her father, who was half Jamaican and half Chinese, and her dark red hair from her Irish mother, wasn't even faintly beautiful, there was something quite extraordinary and outlandish about her that nobody had yet spotted. Her hard life had done nothing to diminish her blazing good spirits and sense of humour.
"Have you ever thought of becoming a model, Nellie?" she had asked.
"A model?" Nellie squawked. "A bleeding model? No, Amy, I ain't ever thought of becoming a model."
"Well, you should." For the 6 weeks of her sentence, in her free time and under Amy's tuition, Nellie walked up and down the prison library with a copy of James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake on her head, until she could do it quite elegantly. Amy advised her not to squawk quite so much and cut down on the swearing. "It might put people off," she warned. Nellie left Holloway, promising she would do her very best not to come back. Amy arranged for Leo to send her £50 to buy some decent clothes and get her hair cut. And Nellie was taken on by the first model agency she went to. Her name was changed to Ellie, and she became an overnight sensation, a model who had picked herself out of the gutter and done well for herself and her three younger brothers, according to the gossip columnists. She stopped squawking and swearing, at least in public, but still retained her broad Cockney accent and was well-liked by everyone she met. 5 years ago, she had retired from modelling and married a minor member of the aristocracy who was extremely rich. She'd visited Amy frequently over the years. Amy had asked for her name never to be mentioned in connection with her friend. "For my family's sake, I'd sooner everyone forgot about me," she said. "Any road, it wouldn't do you much good to be linked with me." At which Nellie had squawked. She didn't give a damn what anyone thought.
"Why did they let you out now?" she asked now.
"I think they were sick of the sight of me," Amy replied. In fact, women given life for murder were usually freed earlier. But her crime and the circumstances surrounding it were regarded as more despicable than most. She felt too overwhelmed to talk. All she wanted was to look out of the window and let the fact that she was out of prison sink in. She had eaten her last meal behind bars, slept there for the final time, would never have to wear prison clothes again. Nellie must have realised how she felt, as they had been travelling in silence for at least an hour, when Amy looked out at the flat countryside and asked, "Where are we now?"
"Essex, girl. Shortly coming up to Chelmsford. By the way, I've bought you some clothes, just a few bits and bobs for the health farm. Leisure things like tracksuits and toweling robes and shorts. Oh, and there's a leotard and a couple of play suits."
"What's a play suit?"
"Sort of very smart pyjamas you wouldn't dream of wearing in bed."
"It's awfully kind of you, Nellie. Thanks."
Amy felt quite choked. Cathy had sent the clothes she was wearing now, the plain black skirt, black jacket and frilly white blouse from Marks and Spencer, along with some pretty underwear.
"I doubt if I would have come through without my friends," she said now to Nellie. "No matter which prison I was in, there was hardly a weekend when someone didn't come to see me. Leo, Cathy, our Charlie, Harry, you. Mam came quite regularly until she died." Mam dying so suddenly of heart failure had been an appalling shock. "My solicitor visited often too." It was due to Bruce Hayward's tireless efforts on her behalf that she'd been unexpectedly released. There was silence again as Nellie appeared to doze off. Amy concentrated on the level fields and little villages of Essex until they passed a sign announcing they were now in Suffolk. It was late spring, and everywhere looked as if it were covered with a lacy blanket of green. The sky was still a mass of heavy, dramatic black clouds.
She was free. At last, the dark days were over. No longer would she have to steer a careful course through the minefield that was prison life, avoiding cliques and being nice to everyone, even the most violent prisoners, truly terrifying women who beat other women up in the showers for no reason at all, as far as Amy could see. One morning, not long after she'd first arrived in Holloway, she'd witnessed a stabbing. The woman had almost died.
"I never saw a thing," she told the governor afterwards when there was an investigation.
It was a cowardly thing to do, but she wanted to stay alive, even if she had no real future to look forward to. She was generally popular with the other prisoners. Many had suffered at the hands of men, their pimps, boyfriends, husbands, fathers, and she was considered something of a heroine for having had the courage to kill the man who was abusing her. No one doubted that he deserved it.
Next morning in Butterflies, it was barely light when Amy woke up. She had a shower, luxuriating in the softness of the white towels and sweet-smelling soap. Having no idea of the programme for the day, she pulled on a pair of loose white cotton trousers. She'd read enough fashion magazines in prison to know they were no longer referred to as slacks, and a loose top to match, then stared at her reflection in the mirror. She looked jaded and pale, but a trifle better than she'd looked yesterday. It must be due to a good night's sleep that her cheeks had a tinge of pink. By the time she was ready to leave Butterflies in 3 weeks, she was determined to look as good as she had before she'd entered prison, apart from being 20 years older. She left the room and went downstairs. It was a beautiful old house, light and airy, with pale walls and polished floors. The clink of dishes could be heard coming from the kitchen, but there wasn't a soul to be seen. She opened French windows, leading to a paved area with benches and tables, and sat down, not minding that the air felt damp and chilly. A glimmer of light had appeared in the east, and the grey sky was becoming brighter. An occasional bird sang, and dew glistened like teardrops on the lawn, which sloped away to a small copse, reminding her of Pond Wood. There was a small village to her left, the only sign of life a spiral of smoke coming from the chimney of a cottage with a thatched roof. Maybe that was the village with the pub. Nellie had wanted to go last night, but Amy said she really wasn't up to it. "I need time to adjust, Nell," she'd explained. Nellie had apologised for being a really thick cow and promised to follow wherever Amy led in future. It was too much too soon, Amy thought. There were too many people. The scenery was too vast, and this place too luxurious. Last night she'd slept in a bed with cream satin covers, in a room with a cream carpet and lace frills on the windows. The contrast between that and a prison cell was hard to deal with. A woman appeared wearing a flowered toweling outfit. Was it a play suit? She sat beside Amy and proceeded to ask loads of probing questions. Amy was forced to invent an imaginary life for herself. Then more guests came, Nellie among them. She looked spectacular in a purple leotard and black tights. She was immediately recognised, and all the attention switched to her, much to Amy's relief. Later on, Nellie produced a bundle of newspapers. "There's something about you in all of these," she said. "They say you've gone to ground. Do you want to read them?" "No, thanks." Amy never read about herself in the press. It was bad enough hearing what people had to say, let alone reading it as well. Over the following weeks, her body was massaged, squeezed, pummeled and tweaked. Her legs were waxed, her nails manicured and painted blushing pink. She was introduced to a sauna, but came out straight away, terrified of being shut in a small hot room and finding herself unable to get out. She swam daily in the sparkling little indoor pool. She'd learnt to swim in Bootle baths with Kathy before the war. Clad in a leotard, she joined in exercises before breakfast, attempted yoga, went for long walks in the persistent rain with Nellie, usually ending up in the village pub, the Cock and Bull, where they stuffed themselves with steak and kidney pie and chips. The food at Butterflies consisted mainly of salad and boiled fish. On the first Friday, the day before most women were due to leave and a new batch arrive, she sat in front of the mirror in the hairdressing salon and was thrilled by how much better she looked. With each day, she could sense her body responding to the pampering. Her skin was no longer grey, and her eyes no longer drooped. She was beginning to feel as if she belonged to the human race again. Her hair was at that very minute being combed out after being set in giant rollers. She had kept it long in prison, cutting it herself, not really caring that she was beginning to go grey. But now it had been cut, styled and tinted, so it looked like brand new hair. The waves and curls were back, and once again they were a gleaming golden blonde, if not as natural as they had once been. "I'm almost myself again," Amy told herself. "At least I am on the outside, if not in my head." Over the next 2 weeks without Nellie, Amy had a lazy time, breakfasting in bed and getting up late, reading a lot, strolling or cycling slowly around the grounds, usually by herself. The weather had improved.
She had facials, a few gentle massages, more yoga. She lay on the floor with her arms stretched out, while a gentle voice encouraged her to relax every single part of her body, while breathing in the scent of a score of flickering candles. On the morning of the day she was due to leave, she had her hair done again. That afternoon, Leah was coming to fetch her. On Friday, she was getting a passport, and on Monday, they would go to Paris. Leo Patterson had always been a charming and exceptionally good-looking man. Amy had been conscious of it from the day they'd met, just as she had been conscious of the fact that he was attracted to her, his son's wife. It had never crossed her mind to encourage him, and if Leo had made a pass, she would have been horrified and had nothing more to do with him. Now things were different. Barney was dead, and so was Elizabeth, who had died alone in the house in Calderstones that had been built from old bricks and old beams. Leo had left for good after her testimony at Amy's trial had nearly resulted in a death sentence. But Amy's feelings for Leo hadn't changed. He was still Barney's father, and any sort of relationship with him, other than friendship, would have felt incestuous. However, she wanted to look her best for him, see the admiration in his eyes, and would like to bet that he had the same effect on most women. She was in the lounge reading a novel, wearing the black skirt and white blouse that Kathy had sent, when Leo was shown in. For a man in his 70s, he looked remarkably handsome, with his lean face and dark grey hair. Not many older men could, or would, have worn such narrow, well-fitting jeans, topped by a smart silver-grey jumper. He blew Amy a kiss and stopped to speak to the receptionist. "So," the woman sitting beside her said in a low voice, "it was true after all." She was about Amy's age, beautifully dressed and exquisitely made up, but nothing could disguise the sadness in her eyes. She'd only arrived at Butterflies the day before, and her name was Audrey. "I beg your pardon. You were having an affair with your father-in-law after all." Amy felt all the colour drain from her cheeks. "I was doing no such thing," she stammered. "It doesn't matter to me whether you were or not," the woman shook her head dismissively. "I remember admiring you very much at the time. I read about you in all the papers and saw you in the news at the cinema." "Admired me? You had the courage to get rid of your bastard husband." "I was too frightened. We're still together after all this time." Amy couldn't think of a single thing to say to this. She had never been so stuck for words. The woman continued, "You look surprised, Mrs. Patterson. See, I know your name, and that your first name is Amy. You had a little girl called Pearl. If you don't want people to recognize you, I suggest you do something with your hair. It was the first thing I noticed." "Thank you," Amy said stiffly. The woman said something, but Amy didn't hear because Leo came up and told her she looked $1 million. She stood up and he gave her a hug. "Would you mind hanging on for a bit?" she asked. "I want to see if the hairdresser is free." She didn't want people pointing at her in restaurants or as she walked down the street. Although she had no intention of hiding her identity, she didn't want to advertise it. "I'd like to buy a dress this afternoon," Amy said to Leo. They were sitting in a pavement cafe in the Champs-Élysées, drinking coffee, watching the traffic pass and listening to the drivers impatiently sounding their horns. It was a lovely May day, neither cold nor warm, and brilliantly sunny. Leo was half reading the Times and wearing the funny little glasses that John Lennon had made famous. It was more or less all they'd done since they got to Paris, drink coffee and stroll up and down the leafy boulevards. Oh, and shop! "Have you seen the one you want?" Leo inquired. "I saw it yesterday, in the Place de la République." "The blue one, or the green one?" He was very interested in everything she bought, just as Barney used to be. Although they were in Paris, she was paying little more for clothes than she would have done back home. But they all had that extra bit of chic, in particular the shoes. "The green one, I think." She found it hard to make up her mind about anything. Until recently, almost every decision had been made for her. The days and weeks ahead, rigidly mapped out. All she'd had to think about was which book to read next, or what to put in the letters she wrote to people. She still woke mornings expecting to find herself in a prison cell. She would never know any greater joy than when she realized she was as free as the wind.
"I'm dying to see Pearl," she said. "See what she really looks like, not just in a photograph."
She'd asked for just one photograph a year, enough to remind her that her daughter was no longer the 5-year-old tot she'd left behind. Leo let the glasses slide to the end of his nose.
"That was a lovely one, taken on her 21st.
"She looked dead pretty," Amy said tenderly. She had a record of Pearl's first Holy Communion, her confirmation, the day she'd left teacher training college. It was Kathy who'd overseen Pearl's career when she expressed the desire to become a teacher. A young couple came and sat at the table in front of them. They immediately wrapped their arms around each other and began to kiss. A waiter came and stood smiling slightly until they'd finished. They ordered, looked deeply into each other's eyes, and kissed again. Watching, Amy felt a pang of envy.
"Barney once suggested we come to Paris for our honeymoon when the war was over," she said.
If she'd been with Barney now, the old Barney, they might well have sat on the Champs-Élysées and kissed. But he wasn't in the mood for honeymoons when he came back from the prisoner of war camp. The thought reminded her of the bungalow where they'd lived, and she asked Leo what had happened to it.
"It was only rented," Leo told her. "I've no idea who moved in after you."
Soon Amy would have to find somewhere to live. For the first time in her life, she would be on her own, and it wouldn't be enough just to be out of prison. She'd want more than that. In a matter of days, she would be 50 and would have to decide what to do with the rest of her life.
Leo had come up with the idea of Amy appearing at a dinner party where the Pattersons, the Currans and Kathy Burns would be present, giving them a really big surprise.
"Isn't that a bit theatrical?" She didn't think much of the idea. "Do they need to be surprised? Why can't they just be told I'll be there?"
"It wouldn't be the same."
"Ah, go on, Amy," he said coaxingly. "I like giving people surprises."
To please Leo, who'd been so marvellous over the years, she agreed. She paid 5 times as much as she had for her other clothes for a plain black fitted dress from Galerie Lafayette. It had a high neck and long sleeves, and the thin material clung to every curve of her slim body. The following day, they flew home from Paris, the holiday over. She was in the ladies' room at the Carlisle Hotel in Southport. It was all highly dramatic. In a minute, she was to wait outside, and a waiter would tell her when Mr. Patterson had ordered champagne and it was time for her to cross to his table. She knew where the table was, but had only seen it from the distance. Her nose was shining, she powdered it, renewed her lipstick, patted her short brown hair. Did it really matter that when she saw her daughter for the first time, she looked like a film star?
"It does to me," she thought. "I've always been concerned with my appearance. Perhaps too much, but it's the way I am."
She went over to the door and raised her hand to open it, when she had a wish that completely took her breath away. What she wished... wished with every single part of her, so hard that it swiftly became an ache, was that when she opened the door in all her finery, Barney would be waiting for her. A 52-year-old Barney, as handsome as ever in his best suit.
"Ah, there you are, darling," he would say, reaching for her hand.
"Would you like a drink before we eat?"
But it was a wasted wish. Now she was trembling and her heart raced. She left the cloakroom and a waiter approached.
"Are you ready, madam?"
Amy nodded and followed the man across the room to where her daughter would be with a young man called Rob, whom Leo had never met.
And there she was, Pearl. So like Barney, with her smooth skin and dark brown hair. She had a quiet face. Could a person have a quiet face? Then Pearl looked up, caught her staring, and Amy said, "Hello, love." And her daughter burst into tears and threw herself into Amy's arms, and Amy was saying, "There, there, love. There, there, don't cry. I'm home now."
After a few days, Amy had lunch in the Adelphi with Harry, while Charlie took her things to Kathy's house, where she intended to stay. Barney's brother had always been perfectly turned out in the old days.
Today he wore a pale grey suit, a white shirt, and a silver tie, the sort of man who could have been taken for a friendly bank manager or the family solicitor. You would never have dreamt he'd once been a soldier who'd stoically fought his way through the war. This was the first time they'd been alone together. He told her she looked fantastic.
"I'd expected you to turn up hollow-eyed like Susan Hayward in that picture, I Want to Live. Have you seen it?"
"If that's the one when she's in prison, then no, Harry, I didn't see it, because I happened to be in prison myself. Didn't she go into the gas chamber in the end?"
"Yes," he said mournfully. "Have I just put my foot in it?"
"Yes, but I don't mind." She gave him a forgiving smile.
"What do you think of your daughter?" he asked.
"She's lovely. I think she's decided she quite likes me after all. I've been expecting coldness, indifference, even rudeness. But she's been very nice, if a bit shy.
In view of the circumstances, it would be a bit blooming ironic if she was anything else but nice," Harry puffed.
"Harry, love," Amy said patiently, "Pearl thinks I murdered her father."
I know, but she's aware there were mitigating circumstances."
"Mitigating circumstances or not, to stab someone to death is a pretty extreme thing to do, particularly when it's your husband."
A waiter came and removed their plates. She hoped he hadn't heard the last remark.
"Do you think Pearl will ever remember she did it?"
Amy shuddered.
"I pray not. If she does, I hope that by then she'll be happily married to that nice boyfriend of hers with the lovely little son." For some strange reason, Gary, with his innocent eyes and sweet nature, had moved her more than anything since she'd come home. Harry spent the rest of the meal talking about Kathy.
"I wish I saw more of her," he said, mournful again.
"Why don't you ask her out next time you meet?"
He'd been hankering after Kathy since the day they'd met in Southport all those years ago. He sniffed miserably.
"She wouldn't want to be bothered with an old codger like me."
"For goodness sake, Harry, you're only 55. That's not exactly ancient."
"I'm 54, actually," he said quickly.
"That's even less ancient."
She felt like hitting him with the spoon.
"When we go back to Kathy's, you can ask her then." "I might."
Amy woke up in the middle of a dream that she couldn't remember, just that it had been one of those heavy, sad dreams that make everything feel hopeless.
It was only 6:15. She lay there, crying quietly, not wanting to disturb Kathy, who eventually got up, had a shower, then knocked on Amy's door and said her name. Amy didn't answer. She heard Kathy make tea and hoped she wouldn't bring her up a cup. But she must have decided to leave her friend to sleep. Downstairs, the radio went on and Amy began to cry properly, sobbing uncontrollably into the pillow. She thought she'd been coping wonderfully, had actually felt quite proud of herself. She'd been impressed with the conversation she'd had with Harry yesterday. It had been civil, pertinent, and faintly amusing. But that was yesterday and this was today, and she felt really despondent, as if there were no point in being alive anymore. It was stupid, but she wished Gary were there, sitting at the foot of the bed and looking at her with his green eyes, talking about his tubs of paint and the cat he'd had in Uganda. He was the same age as Pearl had been when Amy had gone into prison, and he made her feel she'd missed so much. Was it too late for her to become a teacher? It was such an outrageously stupid idea that she stopped crying and laughed hysterically.
Oh yes, she'd be snapped up. Someone who'd been in prison for murder would make an excellent teacher.
It would appear she'd stopped crying until the next time. She put on the lilac dressing gown that Nellie had bought her and went downstairs.
Ah, there you are. Kathy looked delighted to see her. Could anyone have had a better friend?
Why aren't you at school? Amy inquired.
Because it's Saturday and we're going into town later. Had you forgotten? You wanted to buy an Everton football shirt for Gary. Would you like some tea?
Several cups, please.
She already felt better.
It wasn't just Kathy, but the thought of going shopping.
She followed her friend into the kitchen.
I think I'll buy another handbag. I've only got the one.
I wouldn't mind another bag either. It's ages since I bought one.
I'll buy one for you, Amy promised.
There's no need for that, protested Kathy. If I bought one made of solid gold, it wouldn't make up for all you've done for me, Kathy, Amy said with a throb in her voice.
Don't get all maudlin on me, girl.
Kathy looked embarrassed. Amy pulled herself together. If she weren't careful, she'd start crying again. It rained for most of the time in town. They rushed from shop to shop, from Lewis's to Owen Owen's to George Henry Lee's, where they had lunch. She kept thinking about Pearl, who was going out with Stephen Conway today, and hoped she wasn't doing anything foolish. She said as much to Kathy, who assured her that Pearl had her head screwed on the right way. She's a sensible girl. Stop worrying. I can't help it. I hope Rob doesn't find out she's with another man. Perhaps I should have a word with her before she goes to meet Stephen. I'll ring our Charlie. Look at you, Kathy hooted. Not home 5 minutes, and you're already an interfering mother. Oh, all right, I won't ring. She wasn't the least bit surprised when, not long after tea, Leo and Harry turned up, as they did virtually every night. Harry still hadn't invited Kathy out. What did you all do with yourselves before I came home? She asked. Leo said, as it was Saturday, he'd be doing something at the Rotary Club. There's usually a function of some sort. Harry said he'd be propping up the bar in his golf club after a hard day's play. Amy raised her eyebrows. In the rain? Especially in the rain. Real golfers prefer to play when it's raining. Kathy, busy putting on a Frank Sinatra LP, claimed if Amy weren't there, she'd be at the theatre with friends. Any number of friends that I've been neglecting since you reappeared on the scene, Amy Patterson. Very soon we'll get fed up with you, Leo warned. You'll be pleading with us to come and see you. Amy conceded that that would almost certainly be the case. Later, she suggested that they invite Rob and Gary over. She was longing to give the little boy the Everton top. Do you know their telephone number? She asked Kathy. Kathy didn't, but knew Rob lived with his sister in Seaforth. An E. Finnegan was found in the telephone directory, living in Sandy Lane, and a surprised Rob promised to come shortly. What happens if Pearl brings Stephen Conway back and Rob's still here? Kathy asked. Lord, I didn't think of that. But Stephen's playing at the Cavern tonight, so it would be really late by then, and Rob will have gone. Gary was full of the picture they'd been to see, bed knobs and broomsticks. Amy said it sounded fascinating. Afterwards, he and his dad had their tea in a Wimpy. I had beef burger with sauce on, he announced, and little thin chips and pink ice cream. I'd love to have a tea like that. My dad will take you there next week if you want, the little boy said generously. We won't have left for Canada by then, will we, Dad? No, son, not for weeks yet. Rob turned to the others, his face shining with good news. I got a letter this morning, he explained. It was from this chap I worked with in Uganda. His dad's taken over an electronics firm on Vancouver Island, and they want me as head of security to start in August. There was a chorus of congratulations. Leo shook Rob's hand and patted him on the shoulder. Amy wondered where this left Pearl. Would Rob want her to go with him? Would she go if he did? Or had she just decided that Stephen was the man for her? Maybe she didn't want either of them. She gave Gary the Everton top. He said solemnly, Thank you very much, Amy. She helped him put it on there and then, and he asked if he could please play in the garden. It's raining, love, she told him. No, the sun's just come out. So it has. She took his hand. We'll go out there, shall we? Kathy's garden was mainly paved with a border of small shrubs and trees. Amy fetched a canvas chair from the garage and watched Gary kick around an invisible football and score loads of goals in an invisible net. The earth smelled fresh, and the paving stones were already acquiring dry patches that seemed to be growing bigger by the second. The sun was fiery red, and there was scarcely a cloud in the dusky blue sky. It had become a different world than it had been all day, and there was no one there who appreciated it more than she did, or was as strongly aware of the sights and the smells and the wonderful taste of freedom. Rob and Leo came out, and she told them where the chairs were. Kathy turned up the music. By now Tony Bennett had taken the place of Frank Sinatra, and emerged from the house accompanied by Harry. Amy was surprised when they started to dance. Kathy couldn't stop giggling. Charlie turned up looking a bit put out that they were having a good time without him.
You know, you're always welcome, Charlie, Kathy told him. You don't have to wait for an invitation. Where's Marion?
Busy, Charles shrugged. Gary said he was tired, and Amy pulled him onto her knee and buried her face in the blue Everton top. He was badly in need of a mother.
Then all of a sudden, much earlier than expected, Pearl appeared, having come down the side of the house and stood by the entrance to the garden. Amy held her breath. She had a feeling that something momentous was about to happen. And it did.
Rob got to his feet and walked towards her daughter, and a light seemed to go on in Pearl's eyes as she waited for him to come. Their arms went around each other. Rob whispered something. Pearl whispered something back. And Amy knew that everything was going to be all right.
Three weddings. Kathy's was the first. She wore blue lace and a picture hat. Harry, a biscuit-coloured suit. They were married in a register office, because Kathy didn't think getting married in a Catholic church mattered much these days. Her four sisters and five brothers came, along with their spouses and a good proportion of the 24 children they had between them. It was a triumph for feminism, Amy thought, the bride proposing to the bridegroom. The couple left immediately for a cruise around the world. A temporary headmistress was taking Kathy's place until she came back. She wasn't sure if Hilda Dooley's marriage to Clifford Thompson was an even greater triumph for feminism, or a complete forfeiture of women's rights. As far as she could gather, Clifford was marrying Hilda in order to have somewhere to live, and she was marrying him to have the title of Mrs. Oh, and she was also pregnant, but Clifford didn't know. Pearl and Rob got married in the last week of July. Amy would never forget the sight of her lovely daughter as she walked down the aisle of the Holy Rosary Church on Charlie's arm, to where Rob waited to take her hand in marriage. It made up for everything that had happened before. Her loss of freedom, the misery she had borne, the ignominy that had been heaped upon her, the shame she had felt for a crime she didn't commit. They didn't have a honeymoon, as there wasn't time before they left for Canada. Instead, when the reception was over, the newly married couple and Gary came back to Kathy's house, where Amy was living alone, to spend their last few days in England. And now, a taxi was waiting at the end of the path. It was time for them to go. Leo, Charlie and Marion were there to say goodbye. The men shook hands and hugged briefly. Gary flitted from one person to the next, demanding kisses, particularly from Amy, whom he really loved. Pearl threw her arms around Marion, and then Charlie, who led his wife indoors when she began to cry uncontrollably. "Why are we doing this to each other?" Amy asked herself. "Why don't we all stay under the one roof and never part?"
Pearl said goodbye to her granddad.
"Goodbye, darling," Leo said gruffly.
"Mum!"
The word made Amy immediately want to cry, but it was Pearl who was sobbing her heart out.
"Oh, Mum, I've only just got you back, and now I'm going away.
But we'll see each other again at Christmas, love. We'll all see each other again. There's no need to cry.
Bye, Mum.
Bye, love."
Rob helped his new wife into the taxi, where a beaming Gary waited.
"I didn't want her to cry," Amy sighed as she watched the taxi drive away. "I didn't want her to cry. Not so much."
"Amy, darling," Leo said, "after what you did for Pearl, she could cry a million tears and it wouldn't be enough." Epilogue, January 1972. Mrs. Da Silva. It was a spectacular view, beautiful beyond belief, but it made Amy's head swim. It was too much. She could see for miles and miles, had no idea how many, hundreds perhaps. Yet there wasn't a human being in sight, just the endless Pacific Ocean, which was gradually changing from glittering silver to blood red as it began to reflect the dying sun. Amy shifted in her seat. The drone of the plane's engine managed to be both disturbing and hypnotic.
This was only the second time she'd flown, and she was just a hair's breadth away from panic. She concentrated on the view, but the sheer vastness of it was making her heart race and her stomach feel queasy. The sky was an artist's palette of colours, bleeding into each other to make paler, brighter, duller, darker colours. The sun was melting like a golden jelly, its shape changing by the second. She longed to close her eyes against the terrifying magnificence of the sight. But she might never witness anything like this again in her life. It made her feel very small and unimportant, no more than the tiniest speck on the face of the earth. Then all of a sudden the sun vanished, as if an impatient god had thought it was time it stopped dawdling and got a move on, dragging it below the horizon. Amy gasped as night fell in an instant over her portion of the world, leaving merely a silver glow where the sun had been. But then the glow disappeared, and there was just dark sky and dark water, and no indication that there'd ever been anything else. The man sitting beside her gave her a gentle nudge. "She wants to know if you would like a drink," he said. He had a Canadian accent. A pretty stewardess was waiting to take Amy's order. "Just a cup of tea, please," she said, and allowed her eyes to close at last. It was January, and she was on her way home from Canada. The splendid sunset was a fitting finale to the last 4 wonderful weeks. She'd met her sisters, their husbands, and their families for the first time in 20 years. Jackie had had 2 more children since she'd come to Canada, and Biddy 1. She'd stayed a week with Jackie and a week with Biddy, then moved into a hotel to be near Pearl, who was expecting a baby, Rob and Gary, and Leo. To everyone's amazement, Charlie had managed to persuade Marion to join them. Kathy and Harry had interrupted their world cruise and flown all the way from New Zealand. Amy could almost believe that the years in prison had been worth it in return for the dizzying months since she'd been released, culminating in the time spent in Vancouver. So many highs after years of nothingness. So much love. She could easily have believed that before she had died or before the girls had gone to Canada, Mam had told her sisters the truth about Barney's death. Their affection for her hadn't changed. They seemed to understand that she had been driven to killing her husband, which was awful because Barney hadn't deserved to die. But there was something else, a look in their eyes of understanding, admiration, and more love than she merited if she really had been guilty of such a brutal crime. Her neighbour gave her another gentle nudge. "Your tea is here." He pulled down the little table from the back of the seat in front so that the stewardess could put down the tray. "Thank you," Amy smiled at them both, without really seeing them. She turned and stared out of the window where it was too black to see anything. But she didn't want to be distracted and let the memory of the holiday fade away. Oh, Lord, now she was thinking about Barney. If she did that for too long, she would burst into tears and have everyone on the plane staring at her. It really was time she let him go, stopped thinking about him and wishing he were there, wondering what he would look like now, remembering his smile, imagining the things he would say. It was so real in her mind that she'd think of things to say back. New Year's Eve, a week ago, had held an undercurrent of sadness. Amy imagined everyone had felt as she did, that this joining together was the experience of a lifetime, that it was most unlikely all of them would be together again, all the Currans and all the Pattersons. The gathering had been difficult to arrange. Marion had had to take time off work. Pearl might not be able to get away with a small baby. Leo was an old man. Harry had a company to look after, and Kathy a school. Amy was definitely going back. She had just spent a week with Pearl in her comfy little house on Vancouver Island. Her daughter was expecting the baby in the spring, and she'd promised to be there. And Jackie and Biddy were definitely coming to Liverpool to stay with their sister once she found a house of her own. Until then, she would live in Kathy's house. It had been a truly wonderful holiday, but now it had come to an end, and she wasn't sure if she could bear it. She reached for the tea, but her hand trembled so much that the liquid spilled onto the saucer. She quickly replaced the cup. "Are you all right?" Her neighbour placed his hand on her arm. She looked at him. He was a tough-looking man with a crew cut, a grizzled face, and very dark grey eyes, who somehow gave the impression of finding life rather amusing.
Yes. Oh, but why is everything so sad? Why do really wonderful things have to come to an end?
Her eyes were full of tears. So even more wonderful things can happen, he said gently. She almost laughed.
That's a very clever answer.
I have clever answers for everything. He looked into her eyes, as if forcing her to take notice, to see him properly. My name is Frank da Silva. What's yours?
Mother of Pearl by Maureen Lee was read by Neris Hughes and is published by BBC Audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.